go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I am Ben Bolin, and you and I both work at HowStuffWorks.com.
Correct. Yeah, very good, Ben.
Yeah, thanks,
I guess, man. We have to remind people, I suppose. I mean, I think you have to do it once every few podcasts. You know?
Yeah, it's in our contract.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Well, so. Either way, here we are, two guys, faces made for radio and voices of angels, coming back to give you an episode on something that I think is really cool, and this is one for our race fans.
Yes, it definitely is. This is a cool one. This one, boy, this is a really good one. This one was suggested, believe it or not, by two people within about a month of each other, which is kind of unique because when you hear what the topic is, well, the listeners already know, but
right.
This was mentioned by someone named Kirby who wrote in on Facebook in May. And Kirby wrote that we should do a podcast on Chaparral race cars.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also the listener that mentioned the Ariel Adam, and we did a show on that one already.
So yes.
That's two for Kirby. And then this also came from Dan, and Dan is from Austin, Texas. Dan had a more direct comment about this. He said that, you know, he loved the podcast about the Porsche 917 that we did. One of the greatest, you know, race cars of all time, in his opinion, and particularly in the Gulf colors he mentioned, you know, the blue cars. But he says, why not do a podcast on Jim Hall and Chaparral cars? Chaparral was responsible for many of the innovations we see on today's race cars and the engineering approach taken in today's top-level racing efforts. Mm-hmm. The 2C was Jim's first car to use a movable wing, which is also called the adjustable angle of attack, which was later banned by the FIA. And then there's a 2J car, which we're going to talk about, which is the sucker car, which is the first – oh, you know what? We're not going to mention that one yet. You know why? Because we're going to hold off on that one because when we get to the 2J, that's one of my favorite cars.
All right.
One of my favorite race cars you know, in principle.
Okay. Yeah. I think I see where you're going with that.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll talk about the 2J. If you don't know about the 2J, stay tuned because it's an interesting mix.
So to paraphrase Van Morrison, cast your memory back there loud. overcome thinking about Chaparral.
Okay.
So I'm sorry. They're not all going to be funny.
So, at least start with a funny one.
Yeah. Okay. I know. All right.
Fine.
I apologize.
I know. Okay. Yeah. I'll knock it off.
Well, somebody will write in and give us some good jokes.
So
from the 1960s, through the, I guess, mid to early 70s.
Yeah.
We've got an automobile team, a racing team, building some very interesting cars. And our story starts back in 1962, with a guy named Jim Hall and a guy named Hap Sharp.
Yes, that's right. They formed a company called Chaparral Cars Incorporated. And where was that? That was in Texas, right?
Mm-hmm. And
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt, man.
No, that's all right.
Yeah, it's in Texas and
Midland, Texas.
Yeah, and Chaparral is formed by combining their two names.
Oh, okay. Got it. And, you know, here's the crazy thing about this is that, you mentioned that, you know, through the 70s. So you said 60 through the 70s.
Yeah.
Their legacy, it kind of goes on through about the mid 90s, really, if we get down to it. But it's a different type of thing. So we'll talk about that.
Right. Yeah. There's a change.
Yeah. But you're right. You're absolutely right that they built and designed cars in the 60s and 70s that were just, they were outlandish.
They
were crazy cars.
They may as well have been spacecraft.
They really were. And they had this impressive list of drivers. Now, I guess we need to talk about who Jim Hall is, really. Now Jim, he's one of the founders, right?
Yeah. Jim Hall, one of the founders. He is an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost. Now, people who've listened to our Colin Chapman, podcast will recall that it is incredibly important to be an engineer or to at least have an engineer when you found a company.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about the Colin Chapman part?
I don't know about that. Why don't you go ahead and do that? And, I just want to mention something about, Jim's Formula One history.
Okay. Do the Formula One.
Okay. So here's Jim Hall, right? And he's born in 1935. So we're talking about, you know, someone who's what, 76 years old now, is that right?
Mm.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's an American-born citizen. He's a Formula One driver from like the early 1960s, yeah. which is really kind of cool. I mean, that was a neat time to be in Formula One. Remember, mm-hmm. we've talked about this, you know, on many occasions. But from 1960 to 1963, he was an F1 driver. And he drove in several races. He drove in 12 races. He had 11 starts. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever had any wins. But he was, you know, in this, in this exclusive group of drivers that was really, I mean, at the time, the things that they were doing, they were becoming so advanced so quickly. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm stating this right, but racing really jumped in leaps and bounds at this point.
Yeah, exactly. It was at a breakneck pace, and the drivers were working with technology that could be completely untested almost.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the thing. They were somewhere between test pilots and race car
because
drivers.
Because they were just throwing it out on the track saying, here's what makes you go fast.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily the safest thing. In fact, it wasn't close to being safe at that time.
Yeah.
And they just didn't care. They cared about going fast. And it's just the way racing was.
And we're talking about some of the I'm trying to come up with a phrase that describes, I guess, some of the legendary race car drivers. Like, when we say Jim Hall was driving with legendary drivers, we also mean like the Jimmy Clarks, the Graham mm-hmm. Hills, like the people who really pioneered, and their feedback and their experience driving with these new technologies that we've mentioned in like the Lotus and that we're going to mention here later mm-hmm. on, they really informed the way these things evolved into what we recognize in racing today, as well as a lot of conventional vehicles.
Yeah, these are the big names. I mean, he had, in fact, later as we talk about, you know, the Chaparral cars themselves and, you know, the evolution of the vehicles, mm-hmm. You'll find that, you know, not only did Jim Hall drive his own vehicles, mm-hmm. But also Phil Hill, Al Unser, Johnny Rutherford. I mean, in some big, big races, and they had some critical wins. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the history of this car. I think it's really cool. So let's, you want to dig in?
Yeah, let's jump in.
All right. And, you know, one other quick little note here. This reminds me an awful lot of the GT40 story and the Porsche 917 story. It just is one of those things where like they came almost out of nowhere, really.
Yeah, out of the blue, out of left field.
It seemed like it. I mean, I know there's a lot of development and a lot of time that goes into this and, mm-hmm. and work. But really, they kind of came out of nowhere. And, you know, here's a car that, you know, the Chaparral 2, which is their first real push into professional racing, because they had a Chaparral 1, which was just basically a modified road car, really.
And
they didn't call it the 1, of course. It was just a Chaparral. Mm-hmm. And the Chaparral 2 was, you know, of course, Jim Hall was driving, but mm-hmm. I'm reading from ChaparralCars.com here. It says with 25 starts and 15 events, it scored a 7 overall wins, 6 second places, and 2 third places. This is in 1965, I believe, mm-hmm. 64. So this is early on in the company, because remember the company was only formed in 1962.
Yes.
And it just dominated in United States road racing. It was a powerhouse. This mm-hmm. thing, and it had an endurance win. It won at the Sebring 12-hour race against, you know, competitors that have been doing this for decades. Mm-hmm. And here's, you know, this upstart company, you know, 2 years old, and they're winning at Sebring.
And there are some, you know, we do have the duty when we talk about this history to talk about the drivers, but let's also not be mistaken. The technical changes, the technological advances in the Chaparrals drove, no pun intended, mm-hmm. sorry.
Yeah, sure.
I got to plead manslaughter to that joke. It really was driven by a lot of the engineering innovations, like the first air dams, mm-hmm. The first spoilers,
a lot of aerodynamic twists.
That's
the best way to say it, I guess, overall.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, they were really playing around with how to make this car slippery, is the best way to put it, probably.
That's a really good way to put it.
And not only that, they were also playing around with, aerodynamics in pushing the car down. Downforce, of course, you know, everybody'll know that term. They've heard that many, many times. But downforce was key in these. And in fact, when we get to one of the vehicles, that's all the car is about, really. downforce. Brute force and downforce.
Let's go to some more of the vehicles.
Yeah, you know, in the series that they raced in, I do want to get to the vehicles. Series that they raced in were the USRRC, which is the United States Road Racing Championship. They raced in the SCCA, which is the Sport Car Club, Sports Car Club of America. Mm-hmm. Let's see, they raced in the IndyCar series later on. You know, there's just a number of different series that these vehicles competed in, and in the Can-Am series, which is one of I love the Can-Am series, so yeah. We'll talk about that too. But let's go through the cars, and we'll kind of outline when they were around and kind of their highlight of their history here. So the Chaparral 1 that we mentioned earlier actually came about in 1961, prior to the forming of the company Chaparral Cars, yeah. Really. You know, that was the one that was a modified street car, really, or road car, I should say. I don't know if I could call it a street car. And then in 1962, they actually had that's when they came out with the Chaparral 2. I see that 1963 is listed a lot, but I believe that's when it first raced. That's the first season that it competed.
I was wondering about that. So that's the difference, is 1963 is the first time we see this vehicle in a race.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I think you're going to see that number either 62 or 63, depending on where you look. Now, this is from ChaparralCars.com, so I'm going to go with what they have,
yeah.
Of course. 63 for the Chaparral 2. Then they, again, these are like – some of them are open cockpit. Some of them have got a canopy over them. Mm-hmm. Extremely smooth looking road racing cars. And a lot of them have, like we mentioned, aerodynamics. You know, they get into the point where they have these giant wings on top of them, almost like the sprint cars do. I'm trying to think of the World of Outlaws, sort of like that. You know, they have that giant wing on top, but it's a little different. You know, it's just forward facing. The cars remind me a lot of the cars you'd see in like Speed Racer.
Oh, cool. Yeah, yeah. It's weird because the way that they're designed, the aerodynamic nature of it makes it look like these cars were sort of, especially in the front, it makes it look like the cars were worn down by erosion, or the way that stone gets really smooth when water goes over.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. They are so smooth and so slick looking. And they were really, you know, they were unlike a lot of the angular cars at the time. I mean, you know, you'll find some similarities between them and other vehicles, of course, but they were really, really testing the limits of the aerodynamics here in these vehicles. And, you know, they went on to design the 2E and the 2D and the 2G and the 2F. And, you know, it just goes on and on. But 2H, 2J, I think the last one was maybe the 2K in the 80s. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah, I do want to do a sidebar here and point out that I don't know if you are familiar with video games, Scott, but there's a similar counting irregularity in a game franchise called Street Fighter. They had Street Fighter 1, and then they had Street Fighter 2, and then they just kept having different versions of Street Fighter 2.
Really?
So there was never – like eventually there were other iterations, but when we see 2B, 2C, 2K, it makes me think, where's 3?
That's terribly confusing. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's terribly confusing with the video game thing though.
Well, yeah, with the video game thing, it's confusing. With the – there's definitely more of a leg to stand on with racing because they're – The design of the 2 and the 1 are different enough that I think they do qualify for different number. And then what we see with the – although we see a lot of innovations in the 2 series, what we're seeing is more like a revision of an existing thing.
Yes, exactly, especially when you see them all lined up. And there's a link, or rather a tab on Chaparral Cars. You can look up – it's called the Legacy tab. And if you look up under Legacy, it's kind of got a little gallery shot of Jim sitting in the middle of all of his vehicles. And it's really – you can clearly see the evolution of the two two line of cars, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
Can we just get right to it and talk about the car that I want to talk about? Because I think this is the main focus, unless you've got other things you want to fill in beforehand, because that's fine with me. But I'm excited to talk about the 2J.
Okay. I've got just a couple things to add, but I'll pepper them in.
Thank you.
So wait. Let's pause for a drum roll, because this is Scott Benjamin's favorite car, race car in principle.
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. All right, this car, now it raced in the Can-Am series, right? So to begin with, this is the Can-Am series 1970. This is called the 2J, okay? You can look it up anywhere. You can find photos of it. there is no engine size limit in that series at this time, which right there, that should tell you that this is a great car series, a great racing series.
Yeah.
Terribly dangerous, but, you know, fantastic car series.
Mm-hmm.
The 2J, now it had a 700 horsepower engine. Okay. That's pretty strong. Pretty strong.
Because
you're talking about a extremely lightweight vehicle, you know, race, purpose-built race vehicle, open cockpit. I'll tell you, it's, of all the race cars of that era, it's not the prettiest car.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the prettiest car. It's, you know, I'm holding up a picture for Ben to look at right now with the 2J.
Yeah, no,
it's boxy.
See, that's why I'm surprised that you, that this is one of your favorites in principle.
Because of what it does, it's because of, this bridged the gap for so many other advancements in that type of that form of racing, I guess, that road racing type of series.
Okay. No, I see
and
you'll
get
going.
To this, but yeah. Here's a car. Now this was banned. This car was banned from racing.
Mm-hmm.
After it took, you know, everybody kind of lobbied together in the series and said we can't have this car compete against us because it was such a formidable competitor, but it didn't win any races. Now that's unusual, right?
Right.
It took 3 pole positions out of 4 starts that it had. Mm. I mean, it ran the fastest lap at Watkins Glen.
Corners like nobody's business.
Yeah, it had a 6th place finish at Road Atlanta, and that's probably about the best that it did in the entire season in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may think like, well, what the heck is so different about this car? Why would they want to ban this car? It doesn't sound like it's much of a competitor other than, you know, it turned a fast lap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pole position, of course, that's something everybody's hunting for it, you know,
the race.
Here's what's unusual about this car, and you'll spot it right away. I mean, when you look at the Chaparral 2J, it's working on something called the Venturi effect. And if you know anything about the Venturi effect, it's a suction that pulls a vehicle or, you know, a fluid or whatever. It's really, in this case, it's creating downforce for the car.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that I saw it described one time is probably the best way that I've ever heard it described. This car operates like the reverse of a hovercraft.
I heard something like that.
Yeah. It's got rubber skirts underneath the car that come to with just in a fraction of an inch of the track surface.
Mm, centimeters.
Okay. It's that close. Yeah. It's really, really close.
I think.
And I mentioned that it's boxy, and that's so that it has all 4 corners that have, you know, nice, you know, it's almost square.
Mm-hmm.
The car is almost square. But the most unusual feature on this thing, Ben, can you guess?
Is it the adjustable part?
The giant fans in the back of the car.
Ah, yeah, okay.
The giant fans. Now, there's 2 huge fans at the back of this car, and it looks really weird.
Yeah.
But now remember, it's got a 700 horsepower engine.
Right.
These 2 fans are for nothing more than pulling air out from underneath the vehicle. That's all they do. They run independently of the engine. They don't run off of the engine.
Mm.
It's a 45 horsepower snowmobile engine that runs these 2 fans and nothing else.
Which is so similar to hovercraft technology because hovercrafts will have, just as a sidebar for comparison, hovercrafts will also have a different engine. They'll have an engine for propulsion and an engine to manage the air.
Exactly. One to push air under the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
This one
takes air out.
It extracts air. Now this thing, the incredible amount of downforce this thing puts out. I mean, I've heard it called insane amount of downforce, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's able to corner just about as hard as it can go in the straights. It sucks itself to the ground via these 2 giant fans in the back powered by a 45 horsepower
mm-hmm.
snowmobile engine. Now, when you hear it running, the sound of the snowmobile engine overpowers the sound of the car engine at lower speeds. Now, at
mm-hmm.
higher speeds, of course, you're going to hear the bigger engine. But this car, I mean, that's why they call it the sucker car. You know, I mentioned that in the email here.
Right, yeah.
We were just getting to that part where who was it? I think it was Dan was getting all excited about the 2J as well.
And because of this downforce, it could corner at faster speeds.
Yes, exactly.
Like not a few miles faster, guys. Like out corner everything else.
Exactly. Like, you know, after one lap, they're you know, half of the course ahead of the rest of the competition or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. it was that much of a dramatic improvement in cornering. Just able to go into the corners that much harder and exit, you know, without lifting, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible, incredible advantage. And, you know, if you haven't looked at the 2J yet, you know, mm-hmm. as you're listening to us,
mm-hmm.
make a note to do so because it's really just one of those cars that it stands out in history. And this whole idea of downforce and the technology. Now, they may go about it in different ways. There were other cars that kind of imitated this.
You
know, that had similar technology that, you know, draw air out from underneath. And now we do it with, you know, ducting from the front of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Creates that downforce. Or, you know, wings on top of the vehicle. And they still, you know, Chaparral did that as well. But this is one of those cars that this really led the way. They showed you how important downforce was to a car and how much it could give a vehicle like this an advantage.
For one beautiful season.
Exactly, until they were banned.
Right, and let's figure out why they were banned, let's go to one of the drivers of the 2J, Vic Elford.
Mm-hmm.
So Vic Elford, he is a British fellow, and he wasn't able to bring the car to a win, as we said, but he's got some input on it in some interviews you can read. He was driving, he recalls driving the experience and just being able to pretty much smoke everybody else. Mm-hmm. He said it's a wonderful car to drive. It's got a semi-automatic transmission. He said it was complicated to get it running because of just the way it was different. Mm-hmm. from so much of the other technology at the time. But here's where he gets just a little bit – I don't want to call him bitter, Scott.
Okay.
I want to call him maybe blunt.
Oh, okay.
So he says he traces the end of the 2J technology to one person. He says, according to Vic Elford, he blames Teddy Mayer, the boss of McLaren at the time.
Oh, McLaren. Okay.
McLaren, sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
And so
– Really?
Yeah, because the Can-Am had been – and let me quote here from him. The Can-Am had been exclusively the property of the McLaren for 3 years or so, and so he could see Teddy Mayer, could see all the money going away, and basically he killed it. So
wow.
He's saying that's why it was banned. And he said if it hadn't been banned, everybody else in the Can-Am would have followed suit.
You know, I'm making a note here because I want to talk about the McLaren cars sometime in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Bruce McLaren and his vehicles, they were a power or force to be reckoned mm-hmm. with back then, I tell you. So, yeah, Bruce McLaren, I just made a note. We're going to talk about those sometime soon.
Everybody
act surprised. it was an incredible time for racing, the 1970s, okay? Now. They get past the 2J, and there's other models. I'm going to try to look through my list.
Yeah, there's, of course, the 2H, infamously dubbed the White Whale.
Okay.
Have you heard that?
Because of that giant tail on the back?
Those
tails, those are impressive.
Yeah, it has a – okay, so it's long, and it's a skinny car, and it's got this – it's got a wing, basically, mm-hmm. in the middle of the car – and that's to try to counteract different
speed racer. I'm telling you.
I'm
telling you. But you know what? You laugh at it, but you know that hadn't been tried up until that point. And
Right. Now
look at every race car; they've got those tall wings at the back of the vehicle. If you look at a Formula One car, if you look at an Indy car, that's all just an evolution of what you're seeing there. Now you're seeing it in a very dramatic form here because it's on two. It looks like sticks.
Yeah.
It looks like it's on two sticks. Now it's integrated into the back part of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
But every single one of those race cars has it, and if they lose it, they can't race because the back end just flies all over the place. This is critical in keeping the back end of the car down on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all where it starts. I mean, it starts in the Can-Am series with these Chaparral cars. And this company,
mm-hmm.
everything that they did, it all really, really plays into modern day motorsports. I mean, there's definite lineage from that all the way through to what we see today. I mean,
yeah.
You can see it on the racetrack this weekend. It's really incredible. Now, in the 70s, and we're still in the 70s.
Right, right.
In 1978, or by 1978, I should say, they had an IndyCar team. And I'm going to try to, you know, shuffle through a couple notes here to make sure that I'm getting this right. But they had driver Al Unser working for them at the time. Now, Al Unser, you know, everybody probably familiar with that name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just one of the old-timers' names, you know, that you'll hear when related to IndyCar.
Mm-hmm.
Late 1970s, now they actually had a team so successful that, you know, they won the Indianapolis 500, they won the Pocono 500 and the California 500 all within 1 year, and that's considered the IndyCar Triple Crown.
Right, right.
So
right. That's
a big deal, okay? That's kind of like the horse racing Triple Crown,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's something that doesn't happen very often or didn't happen very often. You know, go forward just another 2 years to 1980, they have a car called the Chaparral 2K. Mm. And they called this car, and oddly enough, the ground effect car, which this is one of those things. This is another one of those turning moments because yeah. – You know how critical ground effects are. We've mentioned it several right. times here, but you see it every time an Indy car takes the track. They called this the ground effect car. It was driven by Johnny Rutherford in 1980, and it, of course, won the pole position in 1980. It won the Indy 500 in 1980, and it won the PPG IndyCar Championship that year. So this team is something, you know, it's a dominating team, really. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, Chapman and his Lotus team. They're just continuing to year after year produce.
Mm-hmm. And not just produce, but innovate.
Exactly. Yeah. Innovation. And that's how they continue to grow because, you know, next year, all the competition has what you had. Mm-hmm. If not later in the same season. So they've got to continue to grow like that. The IndyCar thing now, they went away for a while. It went away. Probably in the 80s, I'd say, you know, early 1980s, the team kind of went away. And then in the 1990s, they came back to IndyCar. So here's Jim returning with, an IndyCar team that he has driving. He has John Andretti, he has Teo Fabi and Jill DeFerrin, which are, you know, some big name drivers.
Yeah. So it's not the same people. It's almost like a super group.
Exactly. And, you know, they DeFerrin wins the Rookie of the Year, you know, awards, and you can't do that with a bad car. I'll tell you that. but you know, as late as I think it was 1996, he's in this racing series. Now, Jim is still around.
Yeah.
Jim is still with us. He's, what is he doing now? He's got an interesting business now, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's not retired.
No, do you know what he does? Take a shot. Take a wild shot.
Just take a wild
shot?
Yeah,
wild shot.
Okay. He consults – how about – here's a safe one. He consults on other racing cars.
He may do that. I don't know for sure about that or not, but his main kind of focus that you'll hear about or you'll read about is that he runs a kart racing school. In Oxnard, California. That's where he currently lives. So it's just north of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. If you go to this kart racing school, which is a huge facility, by the way, if you go to the Jim Hall Kart Racing School site, which is online, you can find that easy. A lot of professional drivers have gone through this course with Jim Hall. You'll find Jim Hall out there on the track occasionally he's got race prepared cars that he'll go out in, not just the karts, but you know, other cars that he'll take out on the course and race.
Wow. And Mr. Hall is a
big course. It's not like the little, you know, the little tracks that have the tires around them that you see, you know, like in cities and resort towns.
Yeah.
This is a big time track. It's an actual kart racing school where professionals have gone to train and learn. So it's really, really cool. And, if you want, you can still go see some Chaparral cars that are out, kind of still hanging around, some vintage race cars. Mm. And they're on display in, something called the Petroleum Museum of Midland, Texas. And they have an entire Chaparral car gallery, or they did at the time when the site was updated. And I'll tell you, Ben, the site I don't think had been updated since about 2004. I don't know if that's a good sign or a bad sign that, you know, things are too busy for Jim. He hasn't done it. Mm-hmm. Or maybe he's not in charge of it anymore or what. But, you know, and I'm hoping that it's kind of a permanent exhibit. I would think it would be because it's in Midland, Texas, home of Chaparral cars. And it's a safe place to keep them. I'll tell you that. But, you know, you're able to go and kind of walk around them and see what they're all about.
Did you guys, Texas listeners, did you guys catch that hint we dropped?
Yeah, let us know.
Let us know, Midlanders.
Yeah, exactly. I know there's somebody that's got to be near there, or somebody that's rolled through Midland recently and gone to the Petroleum Museum because, you know, if you've seen these, you probably haven't forgotten them.
I'm still stuck on the ground effect because since we've talked about it before, it's so weird to me, to think that there is technology that is banned. Not because it doesn't work, but because it works well. I mean,
it works too well.
Right. Like all technology, it's been said before that all technology is inherently disruptive, and a destabilizing force to the society in which it's produced. Right. So that.
You just lost me.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm kidding.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. I zoned out.
So, it's sad to me, man, to be honest.
Well, you know what? We see this time and time again in racing that you know, someone gets an unfair advantage and then everybody else lobbies against that person. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, turns out years later, everybody adopts that technology and the sport grows. It grows because of that technology. Now, you could say that, you know, there aren't a whole lot of cars now that, if any, that have two giant fans at the back, you know, that operate under a snowmobile engine. You know, a lot of times that's just because, you know, the rules don't allow to have a second engine in the vehicle, mm-hmm. or else maybe they would.
And I'm not speaking out against the rules entirely, because I understand that if you want these things to be real competitions, there have to be guidelines.
Yeah.
So that it can come down to the driver's prowess.
Sure.
But still, man, it bums me out.
You said it, guidelines. Guidelines. Yeah, not strict, they're rules, but you know, rules are meant to be bent. Not broken, just bent.
So
yeah, that's right. And it's what racing's all about, right? I mean, that's how the sport grows and it evolves.
Sidebar, before you go out, you got one last note?
I do. And you know, this is just one quick thing. If you want to see this Venturi effect in action.
Yes.
Oddly enough, there's a little RC car now on the market that you can get that can drive on the walls and uses the Venturi effect, just like the 2J did. It's, you know, I'm going to mention the brand. This is not a product endorsement or anything.
They don't pay us.
No. It's one of those little air hog cars, you know, like they have the little small helicopters and they have the airplanes. And
oh,
things.
Yeah,
they're
yeah, yeah.
Relatively inexpensive to buy, you know, on the shelf at a toy store. They have, Venturi effect cars. I don't know what they call them. They call them zero gravity cars, I think.
Uh-huh.
Something like that. And you can drive the RC car on the wall and it's really just a fan that's sucking it to the wall. That's exactly the way the 2J works. So if you want to think of it in that simple term.
Yeah.
That's the way it works.
Or if your kid is sweating you to get a art 2J.
How, you know, one quick thing.
Yeah.
How powerful were those motors really? The ones that suck the air out? They say, you know, I've read this one other place and I think, you know what? Actually, it comes from the listener mail and I didn't read this anywhere else.
Okay.
It comes from nowhere else but this email, so I can't verify this, okay?
Yeah.
It says that without the engine, the 700 horsepower engine operating, and I'm paraphrasing because I'm shuffling notes, but without that engine operating, the Chaparral 2J would reportedly go 60 miles per hour with the engine off and the car in neutral because of the velocity generated from the thrust of the two fans at the back of the vehicle. Because, you know, it's pulling
the
air out.
The ones powered by the snowmobile?
Exactly. The 45 horsepower engine, if the car's in neutral, it'll power the vehicle forward on a flat surface at 60 miles per hour. Now, that's reported. You know, who knows if that's true or not.
Right,
but remember, all that air is being pulled out from underneath and pushed out the back of the vehicle. So it makes sense. There's forward.
There is some sort of propulsion.
There's a thrust to the back of the vehicle there. So, yeah, it's going to move forward, but I didn't think it would get going that quick. I mean, 60 miles per hour, that's amazing.
You know, to go back to this point, man, in baseball, when the sport of baseball was still in its infancy, you know, people didn't use catching gloves. And eventually they had these things that were just like leather pads so the outfielders could bat the ball down and then pick it up and throw it.
Yeah.
And it was considered unsportsmanlike to use a glove for some time afterwards. And now, of course, they are a necessary part of the sport.
Of course.
And I wonder if technology in racing is tracing the same sort of evolution, you know? So how long is it going to be unsportsmanlike to have fans?
Yeah, you know, it's just, like we said, it's just a matter of bending those rules.
I'm becoming too much of a nerdy fan of the ground effect. We got to get out of here,
yeah,
Scott.
Yeah, we do.
All right. So, listeners, Kirby, Dan, we hope that you enjoyed this podcast as much as we enjoyed doing it. Hope we answered some of your questions. And the rest of our listeners, thank you guys always for tuning in. Give us a holler on Facebook. Give us a shout on Twitter. Find us on our website, howstuffworks.com. Do you have an idea for a vehicle or a topic you'd like us to discuss in a future episode? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.